choose a random guess.
Okay, actually, we're going to get to random graphs eventually, but most what I'm going to talk about is entropy and randomness and what the heck that really means. And along the way, we're going to do some statistical mechanics and some thermodynamics, and then we're going to get to random graphs. We're going to see that random graphs can be understood with the same kind of statistical mechanical formalism that you would use to understand why it is that 33-degree water is liquid and 31-degree water is solid. And we can look at a problem in graphs and see phase transitions and stuff like that. So actually, I'm going to, just as a teaser, I'm gonna throw out a problem that you can think about if you get really bored by my talking about thermodynamics, which is, let's consider a graph. And by a graph, I mean a bunch of points that are connected by a bunch of edges. Now, I don't require that the graph be in the plane. You know, any point can be connected to any other point or not. So it's an abstract graph. And I want to think of a big graph, like, say, with maybe a million edges or a billion edges. So we're modeling the internet. We're not modeling the social arrangements in this room. You know, this room is small. Okay. And what's more, I want to say, I want to look at graphs that have some properties. And the properties I want to look at is densities of certain features. So, for example, one feature might be that you pick a pair of random points and you say, what are the odds of there being an edge? In other words, how many edges are there? How many possible edges are there if I got n vertices?
And choose two.
And choose two, right. So, well, let's let E be the number of edges divided by n choose two. So this is the fraction of all the edges that are there. And I wanted this to be 60%, and I'm going to give it a little bit of tolerance. Okay? And then you would say, if you take three points, well, they might form a triangle, that is to have all three connected together, or they might not. And we'll let T be the number of triangles divided by how many triangles could you have?
And choose three.
And choose three. And let's say I want there to be, say, 15.26% of all the triangles being there. And again, I'm going to give myself a tiny tolerance. And I want to say, okay, how many such things are there? You know, if I pick a graph, you know, a graph with a million edges, you know, there are 2 to the n choose 2 possible graphs, because every edge could either be there or not be there. And of all those 2 to the n choose 2 possible graphs, how many of them actually have edge density around 0.6 and triangle density around 0.1526? And then if you take one of those, what does it look like? And by what does it look like, I mean, if you take a random graph like that and you pick 4 random points, what's the probability that they form a closed cycle? Or that they form a tetrahedron, or that they have this feature or that feature. You know, what is the density of other features? And how can we even go about answering that sort of question? Now we're going to see that the right formalism is thermodynamics. Okay, so this is the teaser. Oh, the other question is, what happens if I change this number from 1526 to 1528? Does anything change qualitatively? And it turns out that it does. There's a phase transition to 1527. I didn't pick these numbers arbitrarily here. Okay, so let me start with a completely different problem. We've got n people in this room. We're here, n is 4, 8, 12, 13, 14 including me, but I don't count. Okay, and suppose I were to reach in my wallet and pull out 14 $1 bills. And pass them out. And the rules of the game are that I'm going to pass out these 14 $1 bills, and each $1 bill could go to anybody. All right? So how many ways are there for me to distribute these 14 bills?
14
factorial? No, that's how many ways I can distribute them so that everybody gets one. 14 and the 14th, right? The first bill could go to any one of you. The second bill could go to any one of you. The third bill could go to any one of you. And they're not the same bill. I mean, I've got this one really old one with such and such serial number and a different brand new bill with a different serial number. And they may all be $1 bills, but they're different pieces of paper. So they're 14 to the 14th. So I'm going to say a priori that all 14 ways are equally likely. All 14 to the 14th ways are equally likely. So, this is essentially the rule for how physics works. That if you talk about what are, consider all the possible arrangements of gas molecules in this room. So imagine you seal off the room. The room has a particular volume. It has a particular number of particles. Those are fixed. It has a certain total energy. But where are all the particles, and where are the, how fast are they moving, and what direction are they going? The rules of the game are every configuration is as likely as every other configuration. Now, strictly speaking, because it's continuous, you don't count configurations. You have to integrate and figure out the volume of the space of configurations. I'm going to sweep that whole integration versus counting business under the rug.
And 1 over k beta is what I'm calling temperature. In other words, temperature is 1 over so if you have something where you pick up lots and lots of entropy for every little bit of extra bit of energy, big denominator, small ratio, that's low temperature. Okay. So you were probably all taught back in elementary school, what is temperature? Oh, it's a measure of the energy in the system. Or maybe it's a measure of the average kinetic energy or stuff like that. But basically, you're told temperature is heat, sort of. It's some definition like that. And it's nonsense. Because if temperature was heat, then all quantities would have the exact same specific heat. Right? I put a certain amount of heat into this substance, and the amount of extra heat it gets will be the same as I put it into that substance. But here's a substance that heats up really quickly, and here's a substance that heats up very, very slowly. If temperature is heat, that doesn't make any sense. But if temperature is sensitivity to changes in energy, if temperature is basically how hungry is it for energy, because more energy gives it more entropy, well, 1 over temperature is beta is 1 over kT. 1 over temperature is how hungry is it for energy. Then it all makes sense. Just by definition, heat's going to flow from a hotter to colder. Temperature just gives you the direction of heat flow. Okay. So now let's go back to this situation here. We want a particular probability of a particular state is e to particular condition, right? Probability of particular condition is e to the s internal times e to the minus beta energy. And for some reason, people like to write e to the st over kt, and then we have e to the minus energy over kt. And you can put that all together, and you say e to the st minus energy over kt. Or you can write that as e to the minus energy minus st over kt. And it's a little bit of a cheat, because why do we just multiply by t only to divide by t? And for that matter, we had s was k times the log of the number of states. Why do we multiply by k just so we can divide by k? So it's a little bit weird, but what it does show is that what you really care about is you're comparing conditions, not just comparing particular configurations, but comparing conditions, is you care about the energy of the condition, and you also care about the entropy of the condition. And it's this combination, E minus ST, that drives everything. And this is called the free energy. Actually, it's the Helmholtz free energy. If you throw in other things for pressure and volume, you know, throw in extra variables, then you get Gibbs free energy. Don't worry about that. The point is that a free energy is the energy and a combination of the energy and the entropy. Now, what happens when ice melts?
Entropy increases.
Its entropy increases. How come?
Energy is increasing.
Its energy is definitely increasing. It takes lots of energy to melt ice. It takes about 80 calories per gram to melt ice. Big energy. You know, water at 32 degrees has way more energy than ice at 32 degrees, which is another reputation of the nonsense that temperature is sort of a measure of how much heat something has.
So around a phase change, you're going to get really big changes in entropy for small.
Well, the point is that you're trading off a change in entropy for a change in energy. Water has more entropy than ice because in water the molecules can sort of zip right by one another in all sorts of ways. But in ice, they're kind of locked in a crystal. So water has more entropy than ice, but it has more energy. According to the energy, you should always prefer being in an ice state. According to the entropy, you should always prefer to be in the water state. At temperature 32 degrees, the change in entropy becomes more important than the change in energy. If the temperature is high, then entropy is relatively more important. If the temperature is low, then energy is relatively more important. So at low temperature, you really sit down in the low energy states. That's ice. At a higher temperature, you go to the higher energy state that has more entropy, that's water. At really high temperature, you go to the super high energy state, which has super high entropy, that's water vapor. So water melts. Then when you get to, 212 degrees, it boils. Okay. And you get these phase transitions. Okay. Now, I did all of this stuff for entropy. Here's another problem. Suppose I've got a subsystem here connected to a big system here. Except it's more than just energy that's allowed to pass back and forth. It's not just that I could give some of the dollars to the people in this room and some of the dollars to everywhere else. It's also that you can up and leave or somebody else can come back in. Right? That the number of particles isn't fixed. That it's not just, you have energy going back and forth, but you also have numbers of particles going back and forth. How is that going to affect the game? How are you going to handle that?
Changes the number of different configurations.
Right. Every time you get an extra person, there's going to be a certain number more or maybe less different configurations that you can have with these extra people. So what you're going to be interested in is you care about what is the derivative of the number. This is just such a gigantic system that, strictly speaking, the number is a discrete quantity. But since it's a gigantic system, you can smooth it out, treat number as if it's a continuous thing. And we can talk about the derivative of the entropy with respect to the number. And you're going to have the exact same thing as before. You put more particles in here. You have fewer particles out here. You're going to pay a cost that's proportional to that times the number that are internal. Okay. Now, usually you scale this by the temperature to get something that is, equivalent to an energy cost. And you call that a chemical potential. But what it's really saying is how much extra entropy do you get per extra, how much entropy out here are you gaining or losing per extra particle? And you can do the same thing for any quantity that can go in or out. If the volume can change, then you can talk about how much the entropy out here changes. And that's pressure. If you the number, chemical potential. Energy, that's temperature. And I've left out a whole bunch of constants. But any quantity that can go back and forth, remember, all states are equally likely. So all you care about is when you grab one more of them, that leaves one less for the outside. How does that change the entropy of the outside? Oh, that's a new parameter I have to put into the system. Okay. I'm going to wrap up this part of the talk with just talking about three ways that physicists will look at a problem of figuring out what state a particular particle is in. No, I'm sorry, particular system is in. These are called ensembles. There's the microcanonical, which says you fix the total energy. No energy can get in, no energy can get out. So fix En, count states, all equally likely. And this really is the correct description of the world as a whole. If you've got something that's sealed off from the rest of the universe, the energy and the number of particles can't change, and every possible distribution of that energy and number of particles is equally likely. And then what you're really doing is, if you want to understand any sort of condition, you have to count how many ways that condition can happen. You're looking at the entropy of that condition, and that's the only game in town. The next thing is, you talk about the canonical. And that's where you fix the number of particles. But you say the energy isn't fixed. The energy can leak into the rest of the universe or can come back from the rest of the universe. But the rest of the universe has a well-defined temperature. The rest of the universe is so damn big that the SDE is really well-defined. And that gives you a beta for the rest of the universe. And that gives you a temperature for the rest of the universe. And then that tells you that the probability of each state, probability of what I'm going to call microstate, a particular configuration of particles, goes as e to the minus energy over kT, and the probability of a particular condition or a particular macrostate goes as the number of ways to achieve that condition times the likelihood of each of those ways. So that goes as e to the st minus, I'm going to call it e to the minus f over kT. Remember, I erased it. F was E minus TS. Right, and the TS over KT is really just counting how many ways you can have the microstate. And the last ensemble is what's called the grand canonical ensemble. Grand canonical, which says E and N can vary. Neither one of them is fixed. You can gain or lose particles, you can gain or lose energies, and the probability of a microstate goes as E to the minus energy plus mu times the number of particles over kT, where mu is this chemical potential. It has to do with how much entropy you get for every additional particle on the outside. And then if you want the probability of the macrostate, goes as e to the S T minus E minus mu N. Okay. Okay. That's it for thermodynamics. Have I used it the whole hour? Got enough time left?
You got some time left.
What?
2 minutes.
Okay. So now let's change gears completely and talk about random drives. Okay. Oh, I need one more thing about entropy. Suppose I flip a coin a billion times. How many ways are there for it to come up heads? For it to come up heads 60% of the time?
A billion choose 60% of the billion?
Well, yeah, but if you divide that by a billion, or you just sort of, basically, it's how much entropy per coin flip are you going to get if you require things to come up heads 60% of the time? And it turns out that the answer is, this was done by Shannon, who figured out how much information is there in sort of any transmission.
McCloud Shannon?
What, yeah. Yeah, how much information is there in any transmission? If 90% of the time it's a zero and only 10% of the time it's a one, you're conveying less configuration information. Because there are just many fewer such sequences than there are of sequences where you get half zeros and half ones. What he said is the quantity minus some pi log pi. That's the key thing. If you flip a coin, there's a 60% chance heads, so you have 0.6 log 0.6. And there's a 40% chance of tails, so you get a 0.4 log 0.4. If you roll a six-sided die that's weighted, well, you have to do a sum over the six possible outcomes. So this is what's called Shannon entropy. So now, random graphs. Here's a description of a machine for generating random graphs. This is called a graphon. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a function of two variables where two variables range from 0 to 1. And I going to want it to be symmetric. And I'm going to want the value of this function to always be between 0 and 1. So any such function of that sort is called a graphon. And you can think of it as a recipe for giving a random graph. Here's the procedure. Step 1, pick n numbers x1 through xn, all in the interval from 0 to 1, uniformly and independently. So each number has a 30% chance of being between 0.4 and 0.7. The likelihood of being in any interval is the size of that interval, and the distribution for each point is independent of every other point. And then to connect points I and J with probability G of XI and J. So this graphon gives you, a description of how to build the random graph. And it also tells you things like, on the average, what fraction of edges will you have? Well, what do? You pick two points, let's call them, they have the coordinates x and y, and the likelihood of their being connected is g of xy. But you have to average over all the points, and each point could be anywhere. And what is the, what about triangles? Well, you have two points, G, X, Y, and Z. You want X to be connected to Y, Y to be connected to Z, Z to be connected to X. And you just do a triple integral of that, dx, dy, dz. If I give you the graphon, you can figure out the edge density. You can figure out the triangle density. You can figure out anything. And what's more, you can say, okay, how much entropy is there in this process? How many different kinds of, how many, if I give you a random graph built in this way, how many different kinds of graphs are there going to be? And the answer is very much like this. What it is we're doing basically n choose two coin flips. It's n squared over two, approximately, coin flips. And for each coin flip, you're going to get this much entropy, where pi is g of xi xj. So there's this quantity, double integral, of g of xy log of g plus 1 minus g log of 1 minus g, and then we integrate dx dy. And then we multiply this thing by minus a half. This minus sign is this minus sign. The half is because you're only doing n squared over 2 choices. And this is going to give you the entropy per possible edge. So the number of possible graphs that you get actually goes as e to the minus, what is that? So we've got a notion of entropy for these random graphs. We've got a notion of edge density and triangle density. How do we go about figuring out what is, you know, how many different graphs are there with a particular edge density and triangle density? The answer is we look for all graphons where this integral gives you 0.6, where this integral gives you 0.1526, and among those we make this integral as big as possible. You maximize entropy. Okay? And the answer turns out to be a graphon that looks of this form. It looks like 2e, it's e plus something, e minus something, winds up being basically a step function, where what you've really done is you divided the vertices into two clusters, where the clusters have equal size, and any two vertices that are in the same cluster are connected with probability e minus nu, and any two vertices that are in different clusters are connected with probability e plus nu. And it turns out that t winds up being e cubed minus nu cubed. So, you know, solve for it. In general, let me draw you the phase diagram for everything that happens with this edge triangle model. There are a certain number of possibilities for how many edges you can get, for how many triangles you can get. If you have fewer than half of the possible edges, it's possible to have no triangles at all. But then there's a certain formula that gives you the minimum number of triangles from one half to one third edges. Another one from one half to two thirds to three quarters, another one from three quarters to four fifths, another one's from four fifths to five sixths, and you get these different curves, and these are called scallops. They're called scallops. And then the top is t equals e to the 3/2, and that corresponds to the following graphon. You have a bunch of vertices that all talk to each other, and everybody else is left out in the cold. And then somewhere in the middle here is the curve t equals e cubed. And that corresponds to the following graphon. Any two vertices have a probability e of being connected. So what's the likelihood of three vertices forming a triangle? E cubed. And then it turns out that there's a region here where the graphons break into two clusters. They sort of self-segregate into two clusters of equal size. There's another, I'm going to call this 1, 2, 3. possible that self-segregation equals eyes. In this thing, it's similar, but they're not equal size. You wind up with a graph on that looks like small, medium, large. They don't like to talk to each other, but the rules are not quite the same for the first cluster and the second cluster, and the two clusters are not the same size. To use a politically incorrect analogy, this is the dating scenario. Men tend to prefer to date women. Women prefer to date men. But it's not, first of all, the number of men and women are not exactly the same, especially in math. And, well, it's not that you only have, you know, cross. You need certain men date men, some women date women, but this is the kind of scenario that you get in this cluster. When you're above Erdős-Reni, you tend to get the following picture. Small, medium, big. This I call the social scene. You have a certain number of highly social people. And then you have a certain number of mathematicians. And of course, the social people talk to each other quite a lot. And the social people will occasionally have mathematician friends because you know, one person with social skills will get you somewhere. And then the mathematicians never talk to each other. I know, it's not really that way, but it makes a good
difference.
So, and these three describe like 95% of the territory. But as you cross this line, you get a very sharp phase transition. You go, for example, if you're slightly below the Erdős-Reni line, you have something that looks like this, with nu being very, very small. If you're slightly above the Erdős-Reni line, you wind up with a graph on that looks kind of like this. So let's suppose that E is, give me a value of E. Anything other than a half?
Fourth.
A fourth, okay. So this is going to be around a fourth. This is going to be around three-fourths. Around three-fourths. Around And that as you approach Erdős-Reni from above, all that happens is that this sector gets thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner. In other words, the graph on just above Erdős-Reni looks nothing like the graph on just below Erdős-Reni. That's a phase transition. You get places where either the entropy or the derivatives of the entropy are discontinuous. And all of the formalism of thermodynamics comes into play. And then there are additional phases that you get where things have, instead of two clusters, it would have three clusters, or four clusters, five clusters. As you get down into these cusps, things get more and more and more complicated. But these three clusters, each of which are very simple, sorry, three phases, each of which describe just two clusters, are what the typical graph looks like. And you get it by taking what had started off as this combinatorics problem. Consider all the graphs that have this number of edges and this number of triangles and so on, and you turn it into what's really a functional analysis problem. Take all the graphs where this integral gives you a particular number, this integral gives you another number, and maximize this integral. And by the way, how do you do that? How do you maximize something with constrained Lagrange multipliers? So you look, you compute. Let me call this quantity here S of G. Because it's kind of an entropy. And you want to compute the functional derivative of S with respect to the graph on it at any one point. Has to be dE dG plus lambda 2. These are easily computed because E and T are just explicit integrals. So now you've got some equations, and this winds up being minus 1 half natural log of 1 over g minus 1. You just, you work it out. That's what it is. So you have a formula that relates the log of the value of the graphon, or rather the log of its reciprocal minus 1, to, well, this is a constant, because it's just the integral of this, so the derivative with respect to g is just 1. And this is more complicated. So you wind up with some equations, and you need to go about solving these functional equations. And so you've gotten out of the realm of, you know, heavy-duty graph theory and combinatorics and into the realm of, you know, playing around with functions, doing power series expansions, doing all the sort of analysis that you learn to do with Lagrange multipliers. And what comes out of it? Well, theorems that say this is what the graphon looks like just above average trending. And there's this whole complicated phase portrait, all with a microcanonical ensemble. Last point, and then I'll stop. Why don't we want to use a canonical or a grand canonical ensemble? Well, the basic idea behind the canonical ensemble is you have a little subsystem that can trade energy with the rest of the world, but otherwise doesn't care what the rest of the world is doing. That it's not connected to the rest of the world. And one of these graphs, is there a piece of the graph that's really not connected to the, that doesn't care about what happens to the rest? No. We're talking about dense graphs where each vertex is connected to some finite fraction of all the other vertices. Everything is super connected. And we're talking about the total number of edges of triangles, and there's no separation. Where there's no separation, it doesn't make sense to talk about internal and external. And so the physical motivation for doing canonical or grand canonical goes out the window. And there are also some big mathematical problems with, you know, that doing the transformation from energy to temperature requires, it's called a Legendre transform, it may or not, you know, it requires certain functions to be convex, and if they're not, all hell breaks loose, and in this case, they're not. And that's another thing that we were able to prove. So, with that, 559. I think we'll stop.
So basically, the random graphs and the graphon method or process, basically, at least at the, and you said the microcanonical, you don't use a canonical.
That's right.
Canonical, but at the microcanonical level, basically, is just another, is a mathematical metaphor for thermodynamics.
Sure.
Which is
right.
Like your overall point.
Right.
That's cool.
Right, you wouldn't think that the principles of why does ice melt and water boil would have anything to do with why is it that in this region you get graphs that look like this, and over here you get graphs that are doing this other business. But in fact, it's really the same game. At every point, you're just trying to figure out how do you maximize entropy. Entropy is like the driving force in the universe.
At least it's going in one direction.
Yeah.
This reminds me, also just one more comment. This so reminds me of some recent stuff I've been reading about the whole moonshine theorem thing, where string theory has suddenly come in to find out these relations between the groups and modular form of elliptical curve, elliptical curves, I think. It's like string theory, and they're like mathematicians running to string theorists saying, which one is it? Wow.
Yeah, there's some pretty weird stuff coming down. And when, now that stuff is stuff that people talk about, and I say, I don't understand. But.
Me too.
Yeah.